Mindedness was still there, but the courtliness was gone. The man looked at him as if out of a dream, as if divided from him by an immense distance, but with a sort of dreamy distaste, which might turn into active hatred if ever that distance were diminished. He still smiled, but there was something cat-like in the smile, an occasional alteration of the lines about the mouth which even hinted at a snarl. Mark in his hands was as a mouse. At Bracton, the progressive element, having to face only scholars, had passed for very knowing fellows. But here at Belbury one felt quite different. Wither said he understood that Mark had already refused the job. He could not, in any event, renew the offer. He spoke vaguely and alarmingly of strains and frictions, of injudicious behaviour, of the danger of making enemies, of the impossibility that the NICE could harbour a person who appeared to have quarrelled with all its members in the first week. He spoke even more vaguely and alarmingly of conversations he had had with your colleagues at Bracton, which entirely confirmed this view. He doubted if Mark were really suited to a learned career, but disclaimed any intention of giving advice. Only after he had hinted and murmured Mark into a sufficient state of dejection did he throw him, like a bone to a dog, the suggestion of an appointment for a probationary period at, roughly, he could not commit the Institute, 600 a year. And Mark took it. He attempted to get answers even then to some of his questions. From whom was he to take orders? Was he to reside at Belbury? Wither replied, "I think, Mr. Sturrock, we have already mentioned elasticity as the keynote of the Institute. Unless you are prepared to treat membership as a vocation rather than a mere appointment, I could not conscientiously advise you to come to us. There are no watertight compartments. I fear I could not persuade the committee to invent for your benefit some cut-and-dried position in which you would discharge artificially limited duties and, apart from those, regard your time as your own. Pray allow me to finish, Mr. Sturrock. We are, as I have said before, more like a family, or even, perhaps, like a single personality. There must be no question of taking your orders, as you rather unfortunately suggest, from some specified official, and considering yourself free to adopt an intransigent attitude to your other colleagues. I must ask you not to interrupt me, please. That is not the spirit in which I would wish you to approach your duties. You must make yourself useful, Mr. Sturrock, generally useful. I do not think the Institute could allow anyone to remain in it who showed a disposition to stand on his rights, who grudged this or that piece of service because it fell outside some function which he had chosen to circumscribe by a rigid definition. On the other hand, it would be quite easily disastrous, I mean for yourself, Mr. Sturrock, I am thinking throughout of your own interests, quite equally disastrous if you allowed yourself ever to be distracted from your real work by unauthorized collaboration, or worse still, interference with the work of other members. Do not let casual suggestions distract you or dissipate your energies. Concentration, Mr. Sturrock, concentration. And the free spirit of give and take. If you avoid both the errors I have mentioned, then, I do not think I need despair of correcting on your behalf certain unfortunate impressions which, we must admit, your behaviour has already produced. No, Mr. Sturrock, I can allow no further discussion. My time is already fully occupied. I cannot be continually harassed by conversations of this sort. You must find your own level, Mr. Sturrock. Good morning, Mr. Sturrock. Good morning. Remember what I have said. I am trying to do all I can for you. Good morning. Mark reimbursed himself for the humiliation of this interview by reflecting that if he were not a married man, he would not have borne it for a moment. This seemed to him, though he did not put it into words, to throw the burden upon Jane. It also set him free to think of all the things he would have said to Wither if he hadn't had Jane to bother about, and would still say if ever he got a chance. This kept him in a sort of twilight happiness for several minutes, and when he went to tea he found that the reward for his submission had already begun. The fairy signed to him to come and sit beside her. "You haven't done anything about Alcassan yet?" she asked. "No," said Mark, "because I hadn't really decided to stay, not until this morning. I could come up and look at your materials this afternoon, at least as far as I know, for I haven't yet really found out what I'm supposed to be doing." "Elasticity, sonny, elasticity," said Miss Hardcastle. "You never will. Your line is to do whatever you're told, and above all not to bother the old man." 2. During the next few days, several processes, which afterwards came to seem important, were steadily going on. The fog, which covered Edgestow as well as Belbury, continued and grew denser. At Edgestow one regarded it as coming up from the river, but in reality it lay all over the heart of England. It blanketed the whole town so that walls dripped, and you could write your name in the dampness on tables, and men worked by artificial light at midday. The workings where Bragdon Wood had been ceased to offend conservative eyes and became mere clangings, thuddings, hootings, shouts, curses, and metallic screams in an invisible world. Some felt glad that the obscenity should thus be covered, for all beyond the wind was now an abomination. The grip of the NICE on Edgestow was tightening. The river itself, which had once been brownish-green and amber and smooth-skinned silver, tugging at the reeds and playing with the red roots, now flowed opaque, thick with mud, sailed on by endless fleets of empty tins, sheets of paper, cigarette ends, and fragments of wood, sometimes varied by rainbow patches of oil. Then the invasion actually crossed it. The Institute had bought the land up to the left or eastern bank. But now Busby was summoned to meet Featherstone and a Professor Frost as the representatives of the NICE, and learned for the first time that the wind itself was to be diverted. There was to be no river in Edgestow. This was still strictly confidential, but the Institute had already powers to force it. This being so, a new adjustment of boundaries between it and the college was clearly needed. Busby's jaw fell when he realized that the Institute wanted to come right up to the college walls. He refused, of course. And it was then that he first heard a hint of requisitioning. The college could sell today, and the Institute offered a good price. If they did not, compulsion and a merely nominal compensation awaited them. Relations between Featherstone and the Bursar deteriorated during this interview. An extraordinary college meeting had to be summoned, and Busby had to put the best face he could on things to his colleagues. He was almost physically shocked by the storm of hatred which met him. In vain did he point out that those who were now abusing him had themselves voted for the sale of the wood. But equally in vain did they abuse him. The college was caught in the net of necessity. They sold the little strip on their side of the wind, which meant so much. It was no more than a terrace between the eastern walls and the water. 24 hours later, the NICE boarded over the doomed wind and converted the terrace into a dump. All day long workmen were trampling across the planks with heavy loads, which they flung down against the very walls of Bracton, till the pile had covered the boarded blindness which had once been the Henrietta Maria window, and reached almost to the east window of chapel. In these days many members of the progressive element dropped off and joined the opposition. Those who were left were hammered closer together by the unpopularity they had to face. And though the college was thus sharply divided within, yet for the very same reason it also took on a new unity perforce in its relations to the outer world. Bracton as a whole bore the blame for bringing the NICE to Edgestow at all. This was unfair, for many high authorities in the university had thoroughly approved Bracton's action in doing so. But now that the result was becoming apparent, people refused to remember this. Busby, though he had heard the hint of requisitioning in confidence, lost no time in spreading it through Edgestow common rooms. "It would have done no good if we had refused to sell," he said. But nobody believed that this was why Bracton had sold, and the unpopularity of that college steadily increased. The undergraduates got wind of it, and stopped attending the lectures of Bracton dons. Busby and even the Holy Innocent Warden were mobbed in the streets. The town, which did not usually share the opinions of the university, was also in an unsettled condition. The disturbance in which the Bracton windows had been broken was taken little notice of in the London papers or even in the Edgestow Telegraph. But it was followed by other episodes. There was an indecent assault in one of the mean streets down by the station. There were 2 beatings up in a public house. There were increasing complaints of threatening and disorderly behaviour on the part of the NICE workmen. But these complaints never appeared in the papers. Those who had actually seen ugly incidents were surprised to read in the Telegraph that the new Institute was settling down very comfortably in Edgestow, and the most cordial relations developing between it and the natives. Those who had not seen them, but only heard of them, finding nothing in the Telegraph, dismissed the stories as rumours or exaggerations. Those who had seen them wrote letters to it, but it did not print their letters. But if episodes could be doubted, no one could doubt that nearly all the hotels of the town had passed into the hands of the Institute, so that a man could no longer drink with a friend in his accustomed bar. that familiar shops were crowded with strangers who seemed to have plenty of money, and that prices were higher, that there was a queue for every omnibus, and a difficulty in getting into every cinema. Quiet houses that had looked out on quiet streets were shaken all day long by heavy and unaccustomed traffic. Wherever one went, one was jostled by crowds of strangers. To a little Midland market town like Edgestow, even visitors from the other side of the county had hitherto ranked as aliens. The day-long clamour of Northern, Welsh, and even Irish voices, the shouts, the catcalls, the songs, the wild faces passing in the fog were utterly detestable. "There's going to be trouble here," was the comment of many a citizen, and in a few days, you'd think they wanted trouble. It is not recorded who first said, "We need more police." And then at last the Edgestow Telegraph took notice. A shy little article, a cloud no bigger than a man's hand, appeared, suggesting that the local police were quite incapable of dealing with a new population. Of all these things, Jane took little notice. She was, during these days, merely hanging on. Perhaps Mark would summon her to Belbury. Perhaps he would give up the whole Belbury scheme and come home. His letters were vague and unsatisfactory. Perhaps she would go out to St. Anne's and see the Denistons. The dreams continued. But Mr. Denniston had been right. It was better when one had given in to regarding them as news. If it had not been, she could hardly have endured her nights. There was one recurrent dream in which nothing exactly happened. She seemed indeed to be lying in her own bed. But there was someone beside the bed, someone who had apparently drawn up a chair to the bedside and then sat down to watch. He had a notebook in which he occasionally made an entry. Otherwise he sat perfectly still and patiently attentive, like a doctor. She knew his face already, and came to know it infinitely well. The pince-nez, the well-chiselled, rather white features, and the little pointed beard. And, presumably, if he could see her, he must by now know hers equally well. It was certainly herself whom he appeared to be studying. Jane did not write about this to the Denistons the first time it occurred. Even after the second she delayed until it was too late to post the letter that day. She had a sort of hope that the longer she kept silent, the more likely they would be to come in and see her again. She wanted comfort, but she wanted it, if possible, without going out to St. Anne's, without meeting this Fisher King man and getting drawn into his orbit. Mark, meanwhile, was working at the rehabilitation of Alcassan. He had never seen a police dossier before, and found it difficult to understand. In spite of his efforts to conceal his ignorance, the fairy soon discovered it. "I'll put you on to the captain," she said. "He'll show you the ropes." That was how Mark came to spend most of his working hours with her second-in-command, Captain O'Hara, a big, white-haired man with a handsome face, talking in what English people called a southern brogue, and Irish people a Dublin accent you could cut with a knife. He claimed to be of ancient family and had a seat at Castle Mortal. Mark did not really understand his explanations of the dossier, the queue register, the sliding file system, and what the captain called weeding. But he was ashamed to confess this, and so it came about that the whole selection of facts really remained in O'Hara's hands, and Mark found himself working merely as a writer. He did his best to conceal this from O'Hara, and to make it appear that they were really working together. This naturally made it impossible for him to repeat his original protests against being treated as a mere journalist. He had indeed a taking style, which had helped his academic career much more than he would have liked to acknowledge, and his journalism was a success. His articles and letters about Alcassan appeared in papers where he would never have had the entree over his own signature, papers read by millions. He could not help feeling a little thrill of pleasurable excitement. He also confided to Captain O'Hara his minor financial anxieties. When was one paid? And in the meantime, he was short of petty cash. He had lost his wallet on his very first night at Belbury, and it had never been recovered. O'Hara roared with laughter. "Sure you can have any money you'd like by asking the steward." "You mean it's then deducted from one's next cheque?" asked Mark. "Man," said the captain, "once you're in the Institute, God bless it, you needn't bother your head about that. Aren't we going to take over the whole currency question? It's we that make money." "Do you mean—" gasped Mark, and then paused and added, "but they'd come down on you for the lot if you left."
"What do you want to be talking about leaving for at all?" said O'Hara. "No one leaves the Institute. At least, the only one that I ever heard of was old Hengist."
About this time Hengist's inquest came to an end with a verdict of murder by a person or persons unknown. The funeral service was held in the college chapel at Bracton. It was the third and thickest day of the fog, which was now so dense and white that men's eyes smarted from looking at it, and all distant sounds were annihilated. Only the drip from eaves and trees and the shouts of the workmen outside chapel were audible within the college. Inside the chapel, the candles burned with straight flames, each flame the centre of a globe of greasy luminosity, and cast almost no light on the building as a whole. But for the coughing and shuffling of feet, one would not have known that the stalls were quite full. Curry, black-suited and black-gowned, and looming unnaturally large, went to and fro at the western end of the chapel, whispering and peering, anxious lest the fog might delay the arrival of what he called the remains, and not unpleasingly conscious of the weight wherewith his responsibility for the whole ceremony pressed upon his shoulders. Curry was very great at college funerals. There was no taint of the undertaker about him. He was the restrained, manly friend, stricken by a heavy blow, but still mindful that he was, in some undefined sense, the father of the college, and that amid all the spoils of mutability he, at any rate, must not give way. Strangers who had been present on such occasions often said to one another as they drove off, "You could see that sub-warden chap felt it, though he wasn't going to show it." There was no hypocrisy in this. Curry was so used to superintending the lives of his colleagues that it came naturally to him to superintend their deaths. And possibly, if he had possessed an analytic mind, he might have discovered in himself a vague feeling that his influence, his power of smoothing paths and pulling suitable wires, could not really quite cease once the breath was out of the body. The organ began to play, and drowned both the coughing within and the harsher noises without. The monotonously ill-tempered voices, the rattle of iron, and the vibrating shocks with which loads were flung from time to time against the chapel wall. But the fog had, as Curry feared, delayed the coffin, and the organist had been playing for half an hour before there came a stir about the door, and the family mourners, the black-clad Hengists of both sexes, with their ramrod backs and country faces, began to be ushered into the stalls reserved for them. Then came maces and beadles and censors, and the grand rector of Edgestow, then singing the choir, and finally the coffin, an island of flowers drifting indistinctly through the fog, which seemed to have poured in thicker, colder, and wetter with the opening of the door. The service began. Canon Story took it. His voice was still beautiful, and there was beauty too in his isolation from all that company. He was isolated both by his faith and by his deafness. He felt no qualm about the appropriateness of the words which he read over the corpse of the proud old unbeliever, for he had never suspected his unbelief. And he was wholly unconscious of the strange antiphony between his own voice reading and the other voices from without. Glossop might wince when one of those voices, impossible to ignore in the silence of the chapel, was heard shouting, "Take your bucking grapefoot out of the light, or I'll let you have the whole lot on top of it." But Story, unmoved and unaware, replied, "Thou fool, that which thou sowest is not quickened unless it die." "I'll give you one across your ugly face in a moment, see if I don't," said the voice again. "It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body," said Story. "Disgraceful, disgraceful," muttered Curry to the bursar, who sat next to him. But some of the junior fellows saw, as they said, the funny side of it, and thought how Featherstone, who had been unable to be present, would enjoy the story. 3. The pleasantest of the rewards which fell to Mark for his obedience was admission to the library. Shortly after his brief intrusion into it on that miserable morning, he had discovered that this room, though nominally public, was in practice reserved for what one had learned at school to call bloods, and at Bracton, the progressive element. It was on the library hearthrug, and during the hours between 10 and midnight, that the important and confidential talks took place. And that was why, when Featherstone one evening sidled up to Mark in the lounge and said, "What about a drink in the library?" Mark smiled and agreed, and harboured no resentment for the last conversation he had had with Featherstone. If he felt a little contempt of himself for doing so, he repressed and forgot it. That sort of thing was childish and unrealistic. The circle in the library usually consisted of Featherstone, the fairy, Philostrato, and, more surprising, Strake. It was balm to Mark's wounds to find that Steele never appeared there. He had apparently got in beyond or behind Steele, as they had promised him he would. All was working according to program. The one person whose frequent appearance in the library he did not understand was the silent man with the pince-nez and the pointed beard, Professor Frost. The deputy director, or as Mark now called him, the D.D., or the old man, was often there, but in a peculiar mode. He had a habit of drifting in and sauntering about the room, creaking and humming as usual. Sometimes he came up to the circle by the fire and listened and looked on with a vaguely parental expression on his face. But he seldom said anything, and he never joined the party. He drifted away again, and then, perhaps, would return an hour later, and once more potter about the empty parts of the room, and once more go away. He had never spoken to Mark since the humiliating interview in his study, and Mark learned from the fairy that he was still out of favour. "The old man will thaw in time," she said, "but I told you he didn't like people to talk about leaving." The least satisfactory member of the circle, in Mark's eyes, was Strake. Strake made no effort to adapt himself to the ribald and realistic tone in which his colleague spoke. He never drank nor smoked. He would sit silent, nursing a threadbare knee with a lean hand and turning his large, unhappy eyes from one speaker to another without attempting to combat them or to join in the joke when they laughed. Then, perhaps once in the whole evening, something said would start him off. Usually something about the opposition of reactionaries in the outer world and the measures which the NICE would take to deal with it. At such moments he would burst into loud and prolonged speech, threatening, denouncing, prophesying. The strange thing was that the others neither interrupted him nor laughed. There was some deeper unity between this uncouth man and them, which apparently held in check the obvious lack of sympathy, but what it was Mark did not discover. Sometimes Strake addressed him in particular, talking, to Mark's great discomfort and bewilderment, about resurrection. "Neither a historical fact nor a fable, young man," he said, "but a prophecy. All the miracles, shadows of things to come. Get rid of false spirituality. It is all going to happen here, in this world, in the only world there is. What did the Master tell us? Heal the sick, cast out devils, raise the dead. We shall. The Son of Man, that is, man himself, full grown, has power to judge the world, to distribute life without end, and punishment without end, you shall see, here and now." It was all very unpleasant. It was on the day after Hengist's funeral that Mark first ventured to walk into the library on his own. Hitherto he had always been supported by Featherstone or Philostrato. He was a little uncertain of his reception, and yet also afraid that if he did not soon assert his right to the entree, this modesty might damage him. He knew that in such matters the error in either direction is equally fatal. One has to guess and take the risk. It was a brilliant success. The circle were all there, and before he had closed the door behind him, all had turned with welcoming faces, and Philostrato had said, "Ecco!" And the fairy, "Here's the very man!" A glow of sheer pleasure passed over Mark's whole body. Never had the fire seemed to burn more brightly, nor the smell of the drinks to be more attractive. He was actually being waited for. He was wanted.
"How quick can you write two leading articles, Mark?" said Featherstone. "Can you work all night?" asked Miss Hardcastle.
"I have done," said Mark. "What's it all about?"
"You are satisfied," asked Philostrato, "that the disturbance must go forward at once, yes?"
"That's the joke of it," said Featherstone. "She's done her work too well. She hasn't read her Ovid. Ad metam properate simul."
"We cannot delay it if we wished," said Strake.
"What are we talking about?" said Mark.
"The disturbance is at Edgestow," answered Featherstone.
"Oh, I haven't been following them very much. Are they becoming serious?"
"They're going to become serious, sonny," said the fairy, "and that's the point. The real riot was timed for next week. All this little stuff was only meant to prepare the ground, but it's been going on too well, damn it. The balloon will have to go up tomorrow or the day after at latest."
Mark glanced in bewilderment from her face to Featherstone's. The latter doubled himself up with laughter, and Mark, almost automatically, gave a jocular turn to his own bewilderment.
"I think the penny hasn't dropped, fairy," he said.
"You surely didn't imagine," grinned Featherstone, "that the fairy left the initiative with the natives."
"You mean she herself is the disturbance?" said Mark.
"Yes, yes," said Philostrato, his little eyes glistening above his fat cheeks.
"It's all fair and square," said Miss Hardcastle. "You can't put a few 100,000 imported workmen—" "Well, not the sort you enrolled," interjected Featherstone.
"'Into a sleepy little hole like Edgestow,' Miss Hardcastle continued, "'without having trouble. "'I mean, there'd have been trouble anyway. "'As it turns out, I don't believe my boys needed to do anything. "'But since the trouble was bound to come, "'there was no harm in seeing it came at the right moment.'
"'You mean you've engineered the disturbances?' said Mark. "'To do him justice, his mind was reeling from this new revelation. "'Nor was he aware of any decision to conceal his state of mind.' In the snugness and intimacy of that circle, he found his facial muscles and his voice, without any conscious volition, taking on the tone of his colleagues.
"'Well, that's a crude way of putting it,' said Featherstone.
"'It makes no difference,' said Philostrato. "'This is how things have to be managed.'
"'Quite,' said Miss Hardcastle. "'It's always done. Anyone who knows police work will tell you. And as I say, the real thing, the big riot, must take place within the next 48 hours.'
Well, "'It's nice to get the tip straight from the horse's mouth,' said Mark. "'I wish I'd got my wife out of town, though.'
"'Where does she live?' said the fairy.
"'Up at Sandown.
"'Ah, it'll hardly affect her. "'In the meantime, you and I have got to get busy about the account of the riot.'
"'But what's it all for?'
"'The emergency regulations,' said Featherstone. "'You'll never get the powers we want at Edgestow "'until the government declares that a state of emergency exists there.'
"'Exactly.' said Philostrato. It is folly to talk of peaceful revolutions. Not that the canaglia would always resist. Often they have to be prodded into it. But until there is the disturbance, the firing, the barricades, no one gets powers to act effectively. There is not enough what you call way on the boat to steer him.
And the stuff must be all ready to appear in the papers the very day after the riot, said Miss Hardcastle. That means it must be handed in to the DD by 6 tomorrow morning at latest.
"'But how are we to write it tonight if the thing doesn't even happen till tomorrow at the earliest?'
Everyone burst out laughing. "'You'll never manage publicity that way, Mark,' said Featherstone. "'You surely don't need to wait for a thing to happen before you tell the story of it.'
"'Well, I admit,' said Mark, and his face was full of laughter. "'I had a faint prejudice for doing so, not living in Mr. Dunn's sort of time, nor in looking-glass land.
"'No good, Sonny,' said Miss Hardcastle. "'We've got to get on with it at once.' "'Time for one more drink, and you and I'd better go upstairs and begin. "'We'll get them to give us deviled bones and coffee at 3.'
"'This was the first thing Mark had been asked to do, "'which he himself, before he did it, clearly knew to be criminal. "'But the moment of his consent almost escaped his notice. "'Certainly there was no struggle, no sense of turning a corner. "'There may have been a time in the world's history "'when such moments fully revealed their gravity, "'with witches prophesying on a blasted heath, or visible Rubicons to be crossed. But for him, it all slipped past in a chatter of laughter, of that intimate laughter between fellow professionals, which, of all earthly powers, is strongest to make men do very bad things before they are yet, individually, very bad men. A few moments later, he was trotting upstairs with the fairy. They passed Cosser on the way, and Mark, talking busily to his companion, saw out of the corner of his eye that Cosser was watching them. To think that he had once been afraid of Cosser.
"'Who has the job of waking the DD up at 6?' asked Mark. "'Probably not necessary,' said the fairy. "'I suppose the old man must sleep sometime, but I've never discovered when he does it.'
4. At 4 o'clock Mark sat in the fairy's office re-reading the last 2 articles he had written, one for the most respectable of our papers, the other for a more popular organ. This was the only part of the night's work which had anything in it to flatter literary vanity. The earlier hours had been spent in the sterner labour of concocting the news itself. These 2 leaders had been kept for the end, and the ink was still wet. The first was as follows. While it would be premature to make any final comment on last night's riot at Edgestow, 2 conclusions seemed to emerge from the first accounts, which we publish elsewhere, with a clarity which is not likely to be shaken by subsequent developments. In the first place, the whole episode will administer a rude shock to any complacency which may still lurk among us as to the enlightenment of our own civilization. It must, of course, be admitted that the transformation of a small university town into a centre of national research cannot be carried out with some friction and some cases of hardship to the local inhabitants. But the Englishman has always had his own quiet and humorous way of dealing with frictions, and has never showed himself unwilling, when the issue is properly put before him, to make sacrifices much greater than those small alterations of habit and sentiment which progress demands of the people of Edgestowe. It is gratifying to note that there is no suggestion in any authoritative quarter that the NICE has in any way exceeded its powers or failed in that consideration and courtesy which was expected of it. And there is little doubt that the actual starting point of the disturbances was some quarrel, probably in a public house, between one of the NICE workmen and some local Sir Oracle. But as the Stagirite said long ago, disorders which have trivial occasions have deeper causes, and there seems little doubt that this petty fracas must have been inflamed, if not exploited, by sectional interests or widespread prejudice. It is disquieting to be forced to suspect that the old distrust of planned efficiency and the old jealousy of what is ambiguously called bureaucracy can be so easily, though we hope temporarily, revived. Though at the same time, this very suspicion, by revealing the gaps and weaknesses in our national level of education, emphasizes one of the very diseases which the National Institute exists to cure. That it will cure it, we need have no doubt. The will of the nation is behind this magnificent peace effort, as Mr. Jules so happily described the Institute, and any ill-informed opposition which ventures to try conclusions with it will be, we hope, gently but firmly resisted. The second moral to be drawn from last night's events is a more cheering one. The original proposal to provide the NICE with what is misleadingly called its own police force was viewed with distrust in many quarters. Our readers will remember that while not sharing that distrust, we extended to it a certain sympathy. Even the false fears of those who love liberty should be respected, as we respect even the ill-grounded anxieties of a mother. At the same time, we insisted that the complexity of modern society rendered it an anachronism to confine the actual execution of the will of society to a body of men whose real function was the prevention and detection of crime. That the police, in fact, must be relieved sooner or later of that growing body of coercive functions which do not properly fall within their sphere. That this problem has been solved by other countries in a manner which proved fatal to liberty and justice by creating a real imperium in imperio is a fact which no one is likely to forget. The so-called police of the NICE, who should rather be called its sanitary executive, is the characteristically English solution. Its relation to the national police cannot, perhaps, be defined with perfect logical accuracy, but as a nation we have never been much enamoured of logic. The executive of the NICE has no connection with politics, and if it ever comes into relation with criminal justice, it does so in the gracious role of a rescuer who can remove the criminal from the harsh sphere of punishment into that of remedial treatment. If any doubt as to the value of such a force existed, it has been amply set at rest by the episodes at Edgestowe. The happiest relations seem to have been maintained throughout between the officers of the Institute and the National Police, who, but for the assistance of the Institute, would have found themselves faced with an impossible situation. As an eminent police officer observed to one of our representatives this morning, but for the NICE police, things would have taken quite a different turn. If, in the light of these events, it is found convenient to place the whole Edgestowe area under the exclusive control of the institutional police for some limited period, we do not believe that the British people, always realists at heart, will have the slightest objection. A special tribute is due to the female members of the force, who appear to have acted throughout with that mixture of courage and common sense which the last few years have taught us to expect of English women almost as a matter of course. The wild rumours current in London this morning of machine-gun fire in the streets and casualties by the hundred remain to be sifted. Probably, when accurate details are available, it will be found, in the words of a recent Prime Minister, that when blood flowed, it was generally from the nose. The second ran thus. What is happening at Edgestowe? That is the question which John Citizen wants to have answered. The Institute which has settled at Edgestowe is a national institute. That means it is yours and mine. We are not scientists, and we do not pretend to know what the master brains of the Institute are thinking. We do know what each man or woman expects of it. We expect a solution of the unemployment problem, the cancer problem, the housing problem, the problems of currency, of war, of education. We expect from it a brighter, cleaner, and fuller life for our children, in which we and they can march ever onward and develop to the full urge of life which God has given each one of us. The NICE is the people's instrument for bringing about all the things we fought for. Meanwhile, what is happening at Edgestowe? Do you believe this riot arose simply because Mrs. Snooks or Mr. Buggins found that the landlord had sold their shop or their allotment to the NICE? Mrs. Snooks and Mr. Buggins know better. They know that the Institute means more trade in Edgestowe, more public amenities, a larger population, a burst of undreamed-of prosperity. I say these disturbances have been engineered. This charge may sound strange, but it is true. Therefore I ask yet again, what is happening at Edgestowe? There are traitors in the camp. I am not afraid to say so, whoever they may be. They may be so-called religious people, they may be financial interests, they may be the old cobweb-spinning professors and philosophers of the Edgestowe University itself, they may be Jews, they may be lawyers. I don't care who they are, but I have one thing to tell them. Take care. The people of England are not going to stand this. We are not going to have the Institute sabotaged. What is to be done at Edgestowe? I say put the whole place under the institutional police. Some of you may have been to Edgestowe for a holiday. If so, you'll know as well as I do what it is like. A little sleepy country town with half a dozen policemen who have had nothing to do for 10 years but stop cyclists because their lamps have gone out. It doesn't make sense to expect these poor old bobbies to deal with an engineered riot. Last night the NICE police showed that they could. What I say is, hats off to Miss Hardcastle and her brave boys, yes, and her brave girls, too. Give them a free hand and let them get on with the job. Cut out the red tape. I've one bit of advice. If you hear anyone backbiting the NICE police, tell him where he gets off. If you hear anyone comparing them to the Gestapo or the Ogpu, tell him you've heard that one before. If you hear anyone talking about the liberties of England, by which he means the liberties of the obscurantists, the Mrs. Grundys, the bishops, and the capitalists, watch that man. He's the enemy. Tell him from me that the NICE is the boxing glove on the democracy's fist, and if he doesn't like it, he'd best get out of the way. Meanwhile, watch Edgestowe. It might be supposed that after enjoying these articles in the heat of composition, Mark would awake to reason, and with it to disgust, when reading through the finished product. Unfortunately, the process had been almost the reverse. He had become more and more reconciled to the job the longer he worked at it. The complete reconciliation came when he fair copied both articles. When a man has crossed the T's and dotted the I's and likes the look of his work, he does not wish it to be committed to the waste paper basket. The more often he reread the articles, the better he liked them. And anyway, the thing was a kind of joke. He had in his mind a picture of himself, old and rich, probably with a peerage, certainly very distinguished, when all the unpleasant side of the NICE, was over, regaling his juniors with wild, unbelievable tales of this present time. Ah, it was a rum show in those early days. I remember once. And then, too, for a man whose writings had hitherto appeared only in learned periodicals, or at best in books which only other dons would read, there was an all but irresistible lure in the thought of the daily press, editors waiting for copy, readers all over Europe, something really depending on his words. The idea of the immense dynamo which had been placed for the moment at his disposal thrilled through his whole being. It was, after all, not so long ago that he had been excited by admission to the progressive element at Bracton. But what was the progressive element to this? It wasn't as if he were taken in by the articles himself. He was writing with his tongue in his cheek, a phrase that somehow comforted him by making the whole thing appear like a practical joke. And anyway, if he didn't do it, someone else would. And all the while the child inside him whispered how splendid and how triumphantly grown up it was to be sitting like this, so full of alcohol and yet not drunk, writing, with his tongue in his cheek, articles for great newspapers against time, with the printer's devil at the door, and all the inner ring of the NICE depending on him, and nobody ever again having the least right to consider him a nonentity or cipher. 5. Jane stretched out her hand in the darkness, but did not feel the table which ought to have been there at her bed's head. Then, with a shock of surprise, she discovered that she was not in bed at all, but standing. There was utter darkness all about her, and it was intensely cold. Groping, she touched what appeared to be uneven surfaces of stone. The air also had some odd quality about it. Dead air, imprisoned air, it seemed. Somewhere far away, possibly overhead, there were noises which came to her muffled and shuddering, as if through earth. So the worst had happened. A bomb had fallen on the house and she was buried alive. But before she had time to feel the full impact of this idea, she remembered that the war was over. Oh, and all sorts of things had happened since then. She had married Mark. She had seen Alcassan in his cell. She had met Camilla. Then, with great and swift relief, she thought, "It is one of my dreams. It is a piece of news. It'll stop presently. There's nothing to be frightened of." The place, whatever it was, did not seem to be very large. She groped all along one of the rough walls and then, turning at the corner, struck her foot against something hard. She stooped down and felt. There was a sort of raised platform or table of stone about 3 feet high. And on it? Did she dare to explore? But it would be worse not to. She began trying the surface of the table with her hand, and next moment bit her lip to save herself from screaming, for she had touched a human foot. It was a naked foot, and dead, to judge by its coldness. To go on groping seemed the hardest thing she had ever done, but somehow she was impelled to do it. The corpse was clothed in some very coarse stuff, which was also uneven, as though it were heavily embroidered, and very voluminous. It must be a very large man, she thought, still groping upwards towards his head. On his chest the texture suddenly changed, as if the skin of some hairy animal had been laid over the coarse robe. So she thought at first. Then she realized that the hair really belonged to a beard. She hesitated about feeling the face. She had a fear lest the man should stir or wake or speak if she did so. She therefore became still for a moment. It was only a dream. She could bear it. But it was so dreary, and it all seemed to be happening so long ago, as if she had slipped through a cleft in the present down into some cold, sunless pit of the remote past. She hoped they wouldn't leave her here long. If only someone would come quickly and let her out. And immediately she had a picture of someone bearded, but also, it was odd, divinely young, someone all golden and strong and warm, coming with a mighty earth-shaking tread down into that black place. The dream became chaotic at this point. Jane had an impression that she ought to curtsy to this person, who never actually arrived, though the impression of him lay bright and heavy on her mind, and felt great consternation on realizing that some dim memories of dancing lessons at school were not sufficient to show her how to do so. At this point she woke. She went into Edgestow immediately after breakfast to hunt, as she now hunted every day, for someone who would replace Mrs. Maggs. At the top of Market Street, something happened which finally determined her to go to St. Anne's that very day, and by the 10:23 train. She came to a place where a big car was standing beside the pavement, an NICE car. Just as she reached it, a man came out of a shop, cut across her path to speak to the chauffeur of the car, and then got in. He was so close to her that, despite the fog, she saw him very clearly, in isolation from all other objects. The background was all grey fog and passing feet and the harsh sounds of that unaccustomed traffic which now never ceased in Edgestow. She would have known him anywhere. Not Mark's face, not her own face in a mirror, was by now more familiar. She saw the pointed beard, the pince-nez, the face which somehow reminded her of a waxworks face. She had no need to think what she would do. Her body, walking quickly past, seemed of itself to have decided that it was heading for the station and thence for St. Anne's. It was something different from fear, though she was frightened too, almost to the point of nausea, that drove her so unerringly forward. It was a total rejection of, or revulsion from, this man on all levels of her being at once. Dreams sank into insignificance compared with the blinding reality of the man's presence. She shuddered to think that their hands might have touched as she passed him. The train was blessedly warm, her compartment empty, the fact of sitting down delightful. The slow journey through the fog almost sent her to sleep. She hardly thought about St. Anne's until she found herself there. Even as she walked up the steep hill, she made no plans, rehearsed nothing that she meant to say, but only thought of Camilla and Mrs. Dimble. The childish levels, the undersoil of the mind, had been turned up. She wanted to be with nice people, away from nasty people. that nursery distinction seeming at the moment more important than any later categories of good and bad or friend and enemy. She was roused from this state by noticing that it was lighter. She looked ahead. Surely that bend in the road was more visible than it ought to be in such a fog. Or was it only that a country fog was different from a town one? Certainly what had been grey was becoming white, almost dazzlingly white. A few yards further, and luminous blue was showing overhead, and trees cast shadows. She had not seen a shadow for days. And then all of a sudden the enormous spaces of the sky had become visible, and the pale golden sun, and looking back, as she took the turn to the manor, Jane saw that she was standing on the shore of a little green sunlit island, looking down on a sea of white fog, furrowed and ridged, yet level on the whole, which spread as far as she could see. There were other islands, too. That dark one to the west was the wooded hills above Sandown, where she had picnicked with the Denistons. And the far bigger and brighter one to the north was the many caverned hills, mountains one could nearly call them, in which the Wind had its source. She took a deep breath. It was the size of this world above the fog which impressed her. Down in Edgestow all these days one had lived, even when out of doors, as if in a room, for only objects close at hand were visible. She felt she had come near to forgetting how big the sky is, how remote the horizon. Chapter 7 The Pendragon 1 Before she reached the door in the wall, Jane met Mr. Denniston, and he guided her into the manor, not by that door, but by the main gate, which opened on the same road a few hundred yards further on. She told him her story as they walked. In his company she had that curious sensation which most married people know of being with someone whom, for the final but wholly mysterious reason, one could never have married, but who is, nevertheless, more of one's own world than the person one has married, in fact. As they entered the house, they met Mrs. Maggs.
"What? Mrs. Studdock? Fancy!" said Mrs. Maggs.
"Yes, Ivy," said Denniston, "and bringing great news. Things are beginning to move. We must see Grace at once. And is McPhee about?"
"Oh, he's out gardening hours ago," said Mrs. Maggs. "And Dr. Dimble's gone into college. And Camilla's in the kitchen. Shall I send her along?"
"Yes, do. And if you can prevent Mr. Bultitude from butting in—"
"Oh, that's right. I'll keep him out of mischief, all right. You'd like a cup of tea, Mrs. Studdock, wouldn't you? Come in by train and all that."
A few minutes later, Jane found herself once more in Grace Ironwood's room. Miss Ironwood and the Denistons all sat facing her, so that she felt as if she were the candidate in a viva voce examination. And when Ivy Maggs brought in the tea, she did not go away again, but sat down, as if she also were one of the examiners.
"Now," said Camilla, her eyes and nostrils widening with a sort of fresh mental hunger. It was too concentrated to be called excitement.
Jane glanced round the room.
"You need not mind Ivy, young lady," said Miss Ironwood. "She is one of our company."
There was a pause.
"We have your letter of the 10th, continued Miss Ironwood, "describing your dream of the man with the pointed beard sitting making notes in your bedroom. Perhaps I ought to tell you that he wasn't really there, at least the director does not think it possible. But he was really studying you. He was getting information about you from some other source, which, unfortunately, was not visible to you in the dream."
"Will you tell us, if you don't mind," said Mr. Denniston, "what you were telling me as we came along?" Jane told them about the dream of the corpse, if it was a corpse, in the dark place, and how she had met the bearded man that morning in Market Street, and at once she was aware of having created intense interest.
"Fancy," said Ivy Maggs.
"So we were right about Bragdon Wood," said Camilla.
"It is really Belbury," said her husband.
"But in that case, where does Alcassan come in?"
"Excuse me," said Miss Ironwood in her level voice, and the others became instantly silent. "We must not discuss the matter here. Mrs. Studdock has not yet joined us."
"Am I to be told nothing?" asked Jane.
"Young lady," said Miss Ironwood, "you must excuse me. It would not be wise at the moment. Indeed, we are not at liberty to do so. Will you allow me to ask you two more questions?"
"If you like," said Jane, a little sulkily, but only a very little. The presence of Camilla and Camilla's husband somehow put her on her best behaviour.
Miss Ironwood had opened a drawer, and for a few moments there was silence while she hunted in it. Then she handed a photograph across to Jane and asked,
"Do you recognize that person?"
Yes, said Jane in a low voice. That is the man I dreamed of, and the man I saw this morning in Edgestow. It was a good photograph, and beneath it was the name Augustus Frost, with a few other details which Jane did not at the moment take in. In the second place, continued Miss Ironwood, holding out her hand for Jane to return the photograph, are you prepared to see the director now?
Well, yes, if you like.
In that case, Arthur, said Miss Ironwood to Deniston, you had better go and tell him what we have just heard, and find out if he is well enough to meet Mrs. Studdock. Deniston rose at once. In the meantime, said Miss Ironwood, I would like a word with Mrs. Studdock alone. At this the others rose also and preceded Deniston out of the room. A very large cat, which Jane had not noticed before, jumped up and occupied the chair which Ivy Maggs had just vacated. I have very little doubt, said Miss Ironwood, that the director will see you. Jane said nothing. And at that interview, continued the other, you will, I presume, be called upon to make a final decision. Jane gave a little cough, which had no other purpose than to dispel a certain air of unwelcome solemnity which seemed to have settled on the room as soon as she and Miss Ironwood were left alone. There are also certain things, said Miss Ironwood, which you ought to know about the director before you see him. He will appear to you, Mrs. Studdock, to be a very young man, younger than yourself. You will please understand that this is not the case. He is nearer 50 than 40. He is a man of very great experience, who has travelled where no other human being ever travelled before, and mixed in societies of which you and I have no conception. Well, that is very interesting, said Jane, though displaying no interest. And thirdly, said Miss Ironwood, I must ask you to remember that he is often in great pain. Whatever decision you come to, I trust you will not say or do anything that may put an unnecessary strain upon him. If Mr. Fisher King is not well enough to see visitors, said Jane vaguely, you must excuse me, said Miss Ironwood, for impressing these points upon you. I am a doctor, and I am the only doctor in our company. I am therefore responsible for protecting him as far as I can. If you will now come with me, I will show you to the blue room. She rose and held the door open for Jane. They passed out into the plain, narrow passage, and thence up shallow steps into a large entrance hall, whence a fine Georgian staircase led to the upper floors. The house, larger than Jane had at first supposed, was warm and very silent, and after so many days spent in fog, the autumn sunlight, falling on soft carpets and on walls, seemed to her bright and golden. On the first floor, but raised above it by 6 steps, they found a little square place with white pillars, where Camilla, quiet and alert, sat waiting for them. There was a door behind her. "He will see her," she said to Miss Ironwood, getting up. "Is he in much pain this morning?" "It is not continuous. It is one of his good days." As Miss Ironwood raised her hand to knock on the door, Jane thought to herself, "Be careful. Don't get let in for anything. All these long passages and low voices will make a fool of you if you don't look out. You'll become another of this man's female adorers." Next moment she found herself going in. It was light. It seemed all windows. And it was warm. A fire blazed on the hearth. And blue was the prevailing colour. Before her eyes had taken it in, she was annoyed, and in a way ashamed, to see that Miss Ironwood was curtsying. "I won't," contended in Jane's mind with, "I can't," for it had been true in her dream she couldn't. "This is the young lady, sir," said Miss Ironwood. Jane looked, and instantly her world was unmade. On a sofa before her, with 1 foot bandaged as if he had a wound, lay what appeared to be a boy, 20 years old. On one of the long window-sills a tame jackdaw was walking up and down. The light of the fire with its weak reflection and the light of the sun with its stronger reflection contended on the ceiling. But all the light in the room seemed to run towards the gold hair and the gold beard of the wounded man. Of course he was not a boy. How could she have thought so? The fresh skin on his forehead and cheeks and, above all, on his hands had suggested the idea. But no boy could have so full a beard, and no boy could be so strong. She had expected to see an invalid. Now it was manifest that the grip of those hands would be inescapable, and imagination suggested that those arms and shoulders could support the whole house. Miss Ironwood at her side struck her as a little old woman, shrivelled and pale, a thing you could have blown away. The sofa was placed on a kind of dais, divided from the rest of the room by a step. She had an impression of massed hangings of blue. Later she saw that it was only a screen, behind the man, so that the effect was that of a throne room. She would have called it silly if, instead of seeing it, she had been told of it by another. Through the window she saw no trees, nor hills, nor shapes of other houses, only the level floor of mist, as if this man and she were perched in a blue tower overlooking the world. Pain came and went in his face, sudden jabs of sickening and burning pain. But as lightning goes through the darkness, and the darkness closes up again and shows no trace, so the tranquillity of his countenance swallowed up each shock of torture. How could she have thought him young, or old either? It came over her with a sensation of quick fear that this face was of no age at all. She had, or so she had believed, disliked bearded faces except for old men with white hair. But that was because she had long since forgotten the imagined Arthur of her childhood, and the imagined Solomon, too. Solomon. For the first time in many years the bright solar blend of king and lover and magician which hangs about that name stole back upon her mind. For the first time in all those years she tasted the word king itself, with all linked associations of battle, marriage, priesthood, mercy, and power. At that moment, as her eyes first rested on his face, Jane forgot who she was and where, and her faint grudge against Grace Ironwood, and her more obscure grudge against Mark, and her childhood, and her father's house. It was, of course, only for a flash. Next moment she was once more the ordinary social Jane, flushed and confused to find that she had been staring rudely. At least she hoped that rudeness would be the main impression produced at a total stranger. But her world was unmade, she knew that. Anything might happen now. "Thank you, Grace," the man was saying. "Is this Mrs. Studdock?" And the voice also seemed to be like sunlight and gold, like gold not only as gold is beautiful but as it is heavy, like sunlight not only as it falls gently on English walls in autumn, but as it beats down on the jungle or the desert to engender life or destroy it. And now it was addressing her. "You must forgive me for not getting up, Mrs. Studdock," it said. "My foot is hurt." And Jane heard her own voice saying, "Yes, sir," soft and chastened like Miss Ironwood's voice. She had meant to say, "Good morning, Mr. Fisher King," in an easy tone that would have counteracted the absurdity of her behaviour on first entering the room. But the other was what actually came out of her mouth. Shortly after this she found herself seated before the director. She was shaken. She was even shaking. She hoped intensely that she was not going to cry, or be unable to speak, or do anything silly. For her world was unmade. Anything might happen now. If only the conversation were over, so that she could get out of that room without disgrace, and go away, not for good, but for a long time. "Do you wish me to remain, sir?" said Miss Ironwood. "No, Grace," said the director. "I don't think you need stay. Thank you." And now, thought Jane, it's coming. It's coming. It's coming now. All the most intolerable questions he might ask, all the most extravagant things he might make her do, flashed through her mind in a fatuous medley. For all power of resistance seemed to have been drained away from her, and she was left without protection. 2. For the first few minutes after Grace Ironwood had left them alone, Jane hardly took in what the director was saying. It was not that her attention wandered. On the contrary, her attention was so fixed on him that it defeated itself. Every tone, every look, how could they have supposed she would think him young? Every gesture was printing itself upon her memory. And it was not until she found that he had ceased speaking and was apparently awaiting an answer that she realized she had taken in so little of what he had been saying.
I beg your pardon," she said, wishing that she did not keep on turning red like a schoolgirl.
"I was saying," he answered, "that you have already done us the greatest possible service. We knew that one of the most dangerous attacks ever made upon the human race was coming very soon, and in this island. We had an idea that Belbury might be connected with it, but we were not certain. We certainly did not know that Belbury was so important. That is why your information is so valuable. But in another way, it presents us with a difficulty. I mean a difficulty as far as you are concerned. We had hoped you would be able to join us, to become one of our army."
Well, can I not, sir? Said Jane.
It is difficult, said the director after a pause. You see, your husband is in Belbury.
Jane glanced up. It had been on the tip of her tongue to say, Do you mean that Mark is in any danger? But she had realized that anxiety about Mark did not, in fact, make any part of the complex emotions she was feeling, and that to reply thus would be hypocrisy. It was a sort of scruple she had not often felt before. Finally she said, What do you mean?
Why, said the director, it would be hard for the same person to be the wife of an official in the NICE and also a member of my company.
You mean you couldn't trust me?
I mean nothing we need be afraid to speak of. I mean that in the circumstances, you and I and your husband could not all be trusting one another.
Jane bit her lip in anger, not at the director, but at Mark. Why should he and his affairs with the Featherstone man intrude themselves at such a moment as this?
I must do what I think right, mustn't I? She said softly. I mean, if my husband is on the wrong side, I can't let that make any difference to what I do, can I?
You are thinking about what is right? Said the director.
Jane started and flushed. She had not, she realized, been thinking about that.
Of course, said the director, things must